I need to support for things that. Were things that people don't necessarily have to see. So there's something like some rules for mass attention in ADS/DS. The question mark and an exclamation point there. And I actually want to start with something from Sid. I am going to do an introduction, but not first. I want to start with something from DeSitter because that's kind of at the end of the talk and I'm afraid I won't get there. And also, kind of this work, which I hope to get feedback, started in a way from two sources. And one of them was the last time I was here, which I don't remember when that was, a couple years ago. And I was in a seminar that was about fluctuations in cosmology. I mean, I was listening. And the speaker was trying to present some other way of generating a spectrum that's scale invariant. But the mechanism that the speaker was proposing was of a version that it was local causal physical properties happening. And at the end of the talk, this is really capital U, at the end of the talk, Neil says, but she, point to me, proved that the local causal properties, the spectrum of perturbations has to go like k to the fourth. First of all, I wanted to crawl under a desk because I didn't want to be put in an antagonism to the speaker. And second of all, it was something I had pretty much forgotten about. But
it was true.
But it was true. And in a way that I hope might be a little bit interesting. Well, if it is true, it might be actually connected to some stuff in anti-De Sitter. So let me just, I'm gonna write down the brief version of this, for perturbations in cosmology, that there's this old result that there's this vector field, which now I'm calling my favorite vector field, which in standard cosmological coordinates, and I'm talking flat spatial sections here, in standard cosmological coordinates, is this vector field. For small distances, it looks like time translation, which is kind of nice because we would like to think about conserved quantities, energy, that are associated with time translation in cosmology, because we're so used to that from flat space time physics. But then there's also the spatial dilation term. How important this is depends upon, obviously, how far out you are. And there's actually three other vector fields that kind of come into the same category, but they're not my favorite vector fields, so I'm not going to write them down. This vector field has a property, and I'm going to use a similar relation a couple of times in the next hour, so plus some more, that if you take the perturbed stress energy, so that's TAV stress energy, and you contract it, I'm looking on a slice, flat Robertson-Walker cosmology, time-like normal, contracted in the time direction, and then also contract with this vector field, and integrate over some volume. So suppose we have some volume there, that this turns out to be a total derivative. And that is to say, this quantity being a total derivative, when it's a solution to on solutions to the Einstein equations, means that we can write this integral of the perturbations over this volume as a boundary term. And I'm not going to write out what the boundary vector is unless someone asks me, but I think this is sufficient right now. So you can throw this integral off to a boundary term. So here's V, and here's the boundary of V. So using this relation and using these three other vector fields, which are not my most favorite ones, but are useful nonetheless, one can show that if you take the two-point correlation function, so that's the correlation function for delta rho at x, delta rho at y, you Fourier transform, and take the correlation function, that this goes like k to the fourth as k goes to zero, under the important assumptions of, as Neil said several years ago, local causal perturbations. And the point of local causal perturbation, well, the causal actually isn't so important, but the causal is that, in terms of getting the result, the causal is that if we have something happening locally, and because it's causal, that as things expand out, they're always contained in the forward light cone. If you take the volume big enough, the boundary term vanishes. And we use things like that all the time. If you can crank back your memory to Newtonian physics, that when you're integrating using conservation of energy and mass, d by dt of the integral, some perturbation of the energy, take a big volume, and nothing's gotten there yet, so that's just zero. Okay. So this was a result, this k to the fourth spectrum, which in the context of cosmology, this is notable because that's not what is observed. What's observed is this scale invariant spectrum, and this result is another argument out of a list of many arguments of the need for some mechanism, like inflation, that stretches out kind of the causal lengths much bigger than you would have if it was just a Friedman universe some time ago. So I put this down first so I don't forget it. It also had to do with the roots of this work. And the idea that you have perturbations, stress energy sources related to boundary terms. So when I got home from Perimeter after that voyage, I thought, well, I wonder if that's really true, if this is really true. And I'll come back to this, if there's a generalization of it, I'll come back to this towards the end of the talk about possible extensions or opening up this result in some way. So I'll come back to
it. Sorry, in what direction?
Of the spectrum. If I ask myself, having been so vigorously pinned against the wall, it's like, this is a spectrum. And I wondered, well, are there actually other possibilities? Let me go back and look at the construction and see if there were assumptions that took, this was work I did done with Larry Abbott a while ago. If there were assumptions that were made that maybe those assumptions are fine, are actually true for our universe, but it was worth going back and looking. You mean why you would when you would have the boundary term equal to zero?
No, when you would change the form.
So in the simplest case, okay. So instead of doing this at the end, I'll do it at the beginning. Then I'll do the introduction. In the simplest case, if you have delta rho much greater than current terms. So if whatever's going on in the energy density dominates over momentum terms, right? Because this is really a sum over the whole, the momentum vector, then that integral reduces that the integral delta rho equals zero, where now I'm setting boundary terms equal to zero because it's localized, and I'm taking my volume to be big. So stuff I had worked with Neil on a long time ago, I think I remember this, was like cosmic strings, and like loops of cosmic strings. And I love this cosmic string stuff because it's a concrete model of local causal perturbations, and you could get a handle on what you could computing in this framework. The other ones that I have written out, the other vector fields, the other three of them, in the same approximation, that your energy density dominated, say that the first moment of x, y, and z of delta rho equals zero. So these are like first integrals of energy conservation and momentum conservation in Newtonian physics. In Newtonian physics, we have d by dt of these things, because those are the conservation laws. These are like first integrals, and they come directly from the Einstein constraints. That's how you do the proof, and that's why they appear to us as first integrals. So translating this to Fourier space, this gives you in the long wave like limit, which is k goes to zero, 1 power of k on delta rho. This gives you a 2 power of k, but then the correlation function is squaring that, so you get k4. Well, the thing with, if you look at the calculations of perturbations and inflation, they're not local. I mean, I wouldn't want to say they're not causal, but they're not local. You know, the hypothesis is that these things are spread out over long distances. So, you know, well, it gets back to how you think inflation started, and you know, initial conditions for inflation. We're always brought back to thinking about that. Right, so that if it actually is some phase transition in a kind of a portion of the universe, then yes, we have to understand what those boundary conditions are. And if you knew what those were, then maybe then you could make a prediction. Maybe you can reverse engineer and say, well, given what we see, what do we know about this boundary term for initial conditions from inflation? And I get so confused when I start thinking about initial conditions for inflation. You know, how did the phase transition happen? I get confused in the sense of it seems like there's lots and lots of models that people have explored in the last decades, and I kind of don't know where to start with that question. Although thinking about that being led back to the initial conditions for inflation, now I finally understand what I think part of what Jim Hartle is always saying, going around talking, saying, understand the wave function of the universe is the theory of initial conditions of the universe. That, yeah, at some point you run up against what was happening on long scales when inflation started, or whatever started, because that sets the boundary conditions. You know, so.
I think as I was asking with constraints, this result seems to imply you can't get realistic. You can't get a scale very tight, but you can. But the point is, this result only evolves on scales bigger than the core radius at any time. So as the universe evolves, the cosmic strings are always generating stuff from Hubble radius. That's good enough to make galaxies that we see. Okay. But if you go further than the work, you'll get that result at all times.
Right, that's right. Thank you. I didn't. And then there's also the infinite strings, which I didn't draw in this picture. And those you have to try to make some argument, some statistical argument about in terms of if you were to try to say something. So they're infinite. Right. So I kind of wanted to put this in the back burner. And there was another ingredient that went into this talk, which I'm going to try to write over here. Anybody want a drink? And that was, I really feel hidden back there. That was a very different context. Now I'm switching gears to ADS, negative cosmological constant. And that's supposed to be a drawing of a plane. And I'm drawing a planar black hole spacetime. So going out to infinity is this way. And Rob Myers and Gary Horowitz had done some work a couple decades ago now, I think, or decade and a half maybe, about black holes and what they called solitons in ADS. And I thought that this is kind of a picture of one or the other, black hole or a soliton. And I had a couple of graduate students, Jan Ant and Bassam Mamoun. And I thought that a kind of a straightforward but interesting enough calculation would be to compute the SMAR relations for these planar black holes. And that is to say, you want to end up with some relation that connects the mass at one end to, I'm suppressing all factors of d minus 2 and 8 pi's and stuff, to this kappa A, the surface gravity, at the other end, the black hole horizon. And I knew from work that I had done with David Castor and Sergey Ray that when you're talking about black holes in anti-de Sitter for the sphere, I can't get up there. I'll have to walk backwards in this. For anti-de Sitter, lambda, very efficient. That's an A for anti-de Sitter and a lambda at once. For anti-de Sitter, I've done some work with David Castor. David, your middle initial is not A, is it?
No.
Excellent. Okay. And Sergey Ray, in which we were looking at SMAR relations for spherical black holes in ABS. And we found something that we thought was kind of interesting, that if lambda equals zero, and you're talking about an asymptotically flat black hole, then the SMAR relations tell you something, the mass times some number is equal to the surface gravity times the area times some number. Okay. There's four pi's and so forth sprinkled around here. And in order to get such a relation with a cosmological constant, it turns out that you have a term that's proportional to the cosmological constant. Dimensionally, this thing has to have the dimensions of a volume. That's for thermodynamic. It's a thermodynamic volume. And that volume has the interpretation, in a way that I won't digress for, as kind of the volume excluded by the black hole. It's kind of the only finite thing that could come out of an infinite volume. If you can have something with the dimensions of a volume, infinite space-time, that this is the one finite thing that's around, and that's what it comes out to be. So I thought, great graduate student problem. We'll have this lambda thermodynamic volume term. But also, because this is a planar black hole, in addition to the ADM mass, you're going to have tensions. So I'll say a little bit more about what the tension is. So there'll be some relation that relates the tension to other stuff having to do with the geometry. So I thought, okay, that's a great problem, or it's an okay problem. You know, it involves combining different things, that you have this tension going on. So now I'm finally into my introduction. What they found was I'll write down the correct relation. So we have one correct relation. Right. This is just like my classroom at home, there's only one eraser. And it's always the opposite place than where you were, because that's how it works. That you have a second relation that, in one way of writing it, is that the mass minus the tension, L is now the length. So I'm working in a compactified planar black hole so that all these quantities are finite. If you want to let the lengths go to infinity and work in an infinite plane black hole, keep track of the factors of the length, divide by them at the end of the day, you're talking about a mass per unit length. The surface gravity times the area is the difference between the mass and the tension. Problem is, wasn't very easy to get here. It wasn't easy in the way that I thought for the following reason. And now I finally come back to the title. What I would like to talk about is that these guys found that in asymptotically ADS spacetimes with planar cross-sections, that the ADM mass plus the sum of all the ADM tensions has to vanish. I put the label ADM here to emphasize that these are charges defined in an extension of the standard way that ADM used. They're defined completely from the point of view of the gravitational theory, Einstein with cosmological constant. I emphasize that because I realize that from the point of view of CFT, people who think about ADS CFT would say, well, I mean, of course this has to be true. This is like taking the trace of a stress tensor that's living on the boundary, because that's where the charges are computed. Tension is minus pressure, so that you can recognize this once you put the minus sign in as a trace, the diagonal elements of mass, pressure, pressure, pressure. So from the point of view of ADS CFT, you would say, well, of course this is going to happen. However, when Ben and Boston came and said, look, we're stuck. We can't invert this relation to find our SMAR relations because there's this extra constraint. So this leads to a degeneracy in terms of the usual process, if you're familiar with the usual process of writing down SMAR relations. So we can't invert the matrix because there's this extra zero. There's an overdetermancy. Okay, so I started thinking about, you know, why? I mean, I know from CFT point of view, of course, because it's a conformal field theory, but this is not a conformal field theory that we're working in, or that I'm working in. This is gravity. So I asked myself, one of the questions that I want to talk about is why from the GR point of view? So I'll call this the traceless condition. And that's one of the things I would like to address, is why from the GR point of view does one have this traceless condition? The second thing which puzzled me equally is that from having worked through several examples without cosmological constant, there's this well-defined simple relationship between local stress energy sources and gravitational charges that are defined globally at infinity. So it seemed to me that there should be some consistency. There was a consistency problem here in my head. And that in order for consistency to be restored, there should be some local version of this statement if one puts perturbative sources in an ADS space-time. So the second question is, what's a local version? The perturbative sources, delta rho, delta pk. So this is going to be the core of what's left of the talk. And then I want to translate some of this stuff back to positive cosmological constant to the sitter and complete the loop. Before I address question number one or address question number two, for ADS, I want to just establish, make sure that everybody is familiar with the usual relationships between local sources and ADM charges, because otherwise you don't, first of all, there's no surprise value if you're not used to the, you know, it's like trying to teach quantum mechanics, but if they don't know what the usual double slit experiment looks like, you know, where's the surprise value? You can't teach Hawking radiation, right, before people really believe that nothing comes out of a black hole, right? Because there's just no punchline. No, but also from a less comic point of view. So I'll note that the ADM charges are defined at infinity. Actually, maybe I will. Is this what I want to compare this? So for example, for the mass, we take some time equals constant slice or a space-like slice, and it has some boundary that we let go out to infinity, and the ADM mass is defined as as an integral over this boundary of a t equals constant slice at infinity. And the integrand has to do with derivatives of the metric in the far field. And the integrand also has to do with the time translation killing field. That's why we call it the mass. So I'd like to encourage you to think of this as a kind of a Noether charge that's associated with the time translation symmetry. That's why we call it the mass. And I'm also just kind of emphasizing here that the construction, you kind of think of a t equals constant slice, and you look at the boundary of that, and that's where you do your integral. For the tension, the picture is a little different. So this is time, and let's say this is x out of the board, z coming out of the board, and that's a z equals constant slice. So this one was t equals constant. To get at the tension, you turn the construction on its side. I mean, it's a covariant theory. The theory doesn't really care about that so much. And you do an integral also that goes out to infinity. But now this integral includes an integration over time. The space-time being asymptotically static or stationary, the integral over time is trivial. And we have the ADM tension is an integral over the boundary of a z equals constant surface, also at infinity. Derivatives of delta GAB, d by dc. And I encourage you to think of the tension as the Noether charge that's associated with this spatial translation killing field. Now you can see that there's also a dependence on what the boundary is, but I'm suppressing that in the notation over to the right. All right, so those were. I haven't written out what's the integram, but that's fine. That's what I mean by ADM charges. Okay, sources. Suppose you have, first I want to do lambda equals zero, asymptotically flat. One way of identifying, you put in a source, delta rho. This generates a linearized solution. So you solve the linearized equations. Sorry, G is equal to eta plus some perturbation, where the perturbation is due to this source, delta rho. You solve that, the linearized equations. You can look in every textbook which has that. These solutions have one free parameter. So I'll call that C1 for counting, actually not C, call it A1. And when you do the matching, I mean, what you can think of this as a delta function source, or you can think of it as actually a little star, and do an interior solution, an exterior solution, and do the matching. If you do the matching, this coefficient that appears in the far field is equal to the integral of delta rho over the volume occupied by delta rho. When you compute when you have the linearized solution, then you can also compute the ADM mass, and you find that that's also equal to the ADM mass. So there's lots of ways of understanding why we call the M parameter in Schwarzschild or Kerr the mass. You can look at geodesics, you can look at orbits. And it also is true that if you go to a setup where it's nearly Newtonian, you're actually generating it by a small amount of stress energy, that the thing we call the ADM mass is indeed equal to the volume integral of delta rho.
So are you just going to work in perturbation theory and saying I'm just not going to allow any purely gravitational terms?
No, I want to identify what the connection is between sources and ADM charges so that I can then make an argument about why I feel that this should have some local counterpart.
Just to spell it out, you see what I'm worried about, right? You can do purely gravitational excitations, which will have ADM mass as well.
Absolutely. But this is this is a check. If we go back to the simplest near Newtonian situation, although an ADS is not near Newtonian, but it's weakly gravitating sources, that the ADM masses include that case. That's a subset. So this would be far more general than something that we derive here, just like computing the ADM mass is far more general than for this situation, but it gives you the answer that you expect in this situation. So the ADM charges do have the property that they reduce to what you would guess in Newtonian theory in that limit. Obviously, they define much more general limits, but they do have this in this linearized source limit. No, so this is a subset. But the subset, I think, is very important for understanding what these charges mean. Especially, so like, let me go to tension right now. This is, as I say in every textbook, so let's suppose we have Kaluza-Klein, lambda equals zero, and let's say we have two Kaluza-Klein directions. Okay. And now I want to we'll start with flat Kaluza-Klein, and now on top of that, I'm going to add a source of stress energy, which say has planar symmetry. So that this source we describe by a delta rho and two pressures, x and y. Again, you can take this equation and solve the linearized equations, generate the linearized solutions. In this case, if I have, say, two pressures, in this case, there's three free parameters, not free, there's three parameters, independent parameters, in the solution. You would have one, that's the integral of delta rho, and then you have two other parameters that are each the integral of tensions, that's the pressures, x, y. So there's three parameters that are independent in your solution, and you could also check that if you take the formulas for the ADM mass and the tensions now, that this one is still equal to the ADM mass. This is equal to minus the tension in the x direction, and this is minus the tension in the y direction. So tension is minus the pressure. Okay. So this gives, in this very nuts and bolts way, an understanding of what the ADM tension is, that in the case in which we expect to have a nuts and bolts understanding, namely there's a source here, that yes, the tensions are integrals over the pressure with a minus sign for the definition. And I should mention that Harmark and Obers did some sequence of papers exploring this. I think they were working with just the string and did a bunch of work on exploring the phase space of uniform strings, non-uniform strings, and Kaluza-Klein black holes using tension. There's only one tension because they just one with actually tension and mass as the phase-space axes. Okay, so they did a bunch of work on this, and David and I also did, also with Sorge Ray. Okay, so this has to go into the mental background so that I wanted to now turn to the ADS solid time. What's the time? 22. Okay. All right. Actually, I will tell you one more piece of phenomenology about these solutions. As I mentioned, Horowitz and Myers, neither of whom are here, did a calculation on the black hole and the soliton. And they found that the mass of the soliton was negative. And the mass of the black hole was positive. Now, when I was looking at this problem more recently, I thought, well, you know, there's also these other charges there. Let's see how tension comes into the game. And it's kind of interesting if you make a little chart that the mass, okay, so this isn't actually the actual area. There's like some 16 pi's buried in there. So I'll give that a hat, so I'm not lying. So for the black hole, the mass is d minus 2 times the area. For the soliton, the tension, for the soliton, there's actually two distinct types of spatial directions. There's one spatial direction, which is the direction of the soliton or a cigar or bubble, however you like to think about it. So in the, I'll call that the bubble, the tension along the bubble direction has the same value as the mass of the black hole. The other tensions, if you go back to the black hole, the tensions, they're all equal, have negative values, and I should be able to minus A. So that if you add up, there's D minus two of them. There's D minus two spatial plus one times D minus one plus the radial ADS direction. The sum zero. So this is, these are traceless in the sense that I described earlier. For the solitons, the mass and the other tensions, the non-bubble tensions, are all negative, as was the point of the Myers and Horowitz paper, that the mass is negative, and that is minus a hat. So you can see that there's this nice swapping symmetry between, well, I don't know if it's nice or not. There is this swapping symmetry that if you interchange the tension bubble and the mass in one solution and the mass and the tensions for the tensions in the other solution, the solutions are completely symmetrical. I mean, of course, which is suggested by their form, but you might look at the form, which I did, and say, well, what's, these are so symmetrical, there should be, you know, there should be some more symmetry that is just the, this kind of highlights the difference. And both of these space times satisfy that the mass plus the sum of the tensions is zero. So one side question that I think is kind of interesting is if in this, in ADS, if just looking at the mass is actually the right stability criterion, or more broadly, how do the tensions come into the stability criterion of this. So I'll just throw that out as a comment. So we had a certain amount of evidence for this. if you actually do the calculation for an asymptotically EDS spacetime, so by this, so asymptotically ADS, sorry, I should have brought some belt, a belt and pants that had belt buckles with this thing. Okay. If you say, I'm looking at solutions, then you can compute a relationship between these fall-off coefficients, what I've called the Cs, in the far field, and you can compute the ADM charges. And what you find is that T always holds. That the traceless condition is indeed always, by direct computation of the charges and solving the Einstein's equations to the extent where you can relate the different C alpha betas to C sub r. So this is just true, and I ask myself, why is it true? What's the geometrical reason from the point of view of general relativity? That was one question. And I also asked myself, this is really weird from the point of view of this calculation, which is fortunately still on the board. If this was in a lambda equals zero Kaluza-Klein spacetime, I can specify the equation of state of my source. So I can specify delta rho and two pressures. And this is like just a very simple model. It's just all symmetries in the plane. And then I generate three independent charges. But this tracelessness condition is telling me that I couldn't do that with a negative cosmological constant, that there's something that would have to give here, that these three can't be independent if the linearized solutions works the same way. So that's what led me to the idea that, gee, I'm really going to have to study what the perturbation equations look like and see if there's some local version of a constraint on what kind of sources you can put down in ADS so it's consistent with this, because that's the relationship that you have without any cosmological constant, is that you have this independence. So there was something that wasn't going to work in terms of repeating this calculation with a negative cosmological constant. And, you know, I was kind of familiar with the idea that there are constraints of perturbations once you have a background from the cosmology. So I'll just tell you what the idea of the construction is, because now we have most of the pieces on the board. So these pictures will do with adding the negative cosmological constant. This condition of tracelessness must have something to do with my favorite vector field, now in anti-de Sitter. So in anti-de Sitter has this conformal isometry. I don't want to say conformal Killing vector, because it's not a conformal Killing vector, it's a Killing vector, which is just the analytic continuation of this vector field in cosmology. In these coordinates, so this Killing vector in ADS encodes, in the usual way the Killing vectors do, the conformal isometry. Of anti-de Sitter. So it seemed pretty clear that this traceless condition was going to have something to do with that vector field, but what? So the construction that ended up working, instead of drawing these slices, so these slices are drawn to connect infinity to the interior. And that's why you end up having, in the first law, for example, that delta M is related to kappa delta A, because the first law works with this kind of construction, and you vary what's happening on the boundary at infinity, and that's related to what's happening on the boundary at interior. And you can actually do a similar construction with the tension, relate delta tension to, it turns out, to be the area times delta kappa in that case. So these surfaces are constructed to relate the interior to the exterior. On the other hand, the tracelessness condition is something, is a statement about what's going on near infinity. The tension and the mass are all defined at infinity. So the surface that you choose, or that ended up working, is an R equals R0 surface, where then R0 is going towards infinity, so you're working in the asymptotic ADS region. And this surface has this boundary, all these different sides. The workhorse of proving either the first law or the Smar relations, or of proving this relation, I'm not going to go through the proof because I've been babbling away. And time's going. But I'll write down the answer.
Has anybody
ever gotten strangled wrapping this around them? Either or by audience assisted, maybe? Question.
Sorry, can I just catch up? So it's the idea that you're going to use the sub-rules to constrain the types of sources that you can have that are consistent with being asymptotic ADS. And I think there's a similar thing that happens, and this might be where you're going, in the sitter, where Joe Conlon showed recently, is where I've seen it, where he forbids certain types of sources in the sitter because they violate the sitter entropy. And is that a similar kind of thing? So those sources violate the sitter entropy mean that you don't have asymptotic in the sitter space, so they're forbidden, and you're going to say I forbid certain types of sources by some rules. Constraints of their equation state because they wouldn't be asymptotic to be ABS if they didn't satisfy this constraint.
Okay, well, let me talk about the second part first. Well, actually, let me table your question for a moment because I have actually kind of set this up, and it's there's two separate statements. One is that we can prove that the ADM charges have to satisfy this condition because of the vanishing of another charge that I'm going to associate with this conformal isometry. So if you call that a scaling vector field or a dilatation vector field, say we introduce a scaling charge that's associated with that, that charge vanishes. And the vanishing of that charge is equivalent to this traceless condition. And then an independent calculation, where you actually just get your hands dirty and write out the perturbative equations for sources in ADS, shows that if you are going to have these boundary conditions, then the sources have to obey the similar local conditions.
So if I put in a source that didn't obey that,
then you wouldn't get those asymptotics. So you can put in other sources. The asymptotics, and you might guess what goes wrong is you get a logarithmic kind of term, which might be interesting in its own right, but would not give finite ADM masses or tensions. But to answer the first part of your question, those are two independent calculations, which are fully consistent with each other. But that's a little bit different than saying, OK, I believe this result, and we'll argue backwards. You know, although maybe if you just believe the result, you would argue backwards. So I know, I realize it's fairly late, so I'll just say with the punch, how this comes out from this framework. is that using Hamilton, if I had the Hamiltonian framework, the easiest to work with for this, and if you take the stress energy tensor dotted into some normal, I call these W's, I'm not prejudiced that, and you integrate this over a volume, then what you get is a total derivative that's on solutions. So really, you replace the delta TAB with delta Einstein tensor. So I'm not writing that down. And then you vary the Einstein tensor. And when you do the variation, you can always arrange to get total derivative, but then there's junk left over, stuff left over. So this is over a total derivative. And then you have a bunch of some PDEs. And this is one you could think about. This is how you derive equations of motion in the Hamiltonian format, for example. So the condition for having that this, if those PDEs are gives you something that's equal to zero, then you've said that the integral of the perturbed stress energy is equal to a total divergence. And if we in particular focus on the case where there's no stress energy, to get back to your pure gravity question, then what we have is that the integral over all boundaries in the case of black holes, the interesting boundaries, if you pick your slice right, are the horizon and infinity. And you do this correctly, that's the first law. So you're connecting one boundary to another boundary. So that picture would go to the way up at the top with the time equals constant slice. How do you get this to be zero? So there's this big mess here that has to vanish. And it turns out that that's a killing vector. If you feed in that W is a killing vector for vacuum space times or vacuum plus lambda, the answer is a killing vector will do the trick. For cosmological, if it's not vacuum, it turns out the set of PDEs are not for killing vectors. It's something more general. And in Robertson-Walker space times, it turns out they're solutions. So these actually hold for a general Robertson-Walker, but they're only killing vectors in De Sitter. So what I wanted to do was to use this relationship in a kind of non-standard way on this surface. Now this surface isn't going to intersect the horizon. I've specifically chosen it, so it's just in the asymptotic region. So, but we have from this general result that I've only, barely mentioned, that we have a vanishing of a certain boundary term. So what I did was to input here my favorite vector field and this boundary. Now, in analogy with these other lines that for some reason came up directly above that, I'll call that charge associated with V, and we could call that a scaling charge because V is kind of a scaling or dilatation killing vector. Because this boundary has no interior, there's no inside there, this charge is just going to vanish in space-time. So then the question is, what is this charge? Okay, so now, so far, I've just defined things. But we have this, and I haven't written it down, but there's an explicit long boundary term here. And if you write that out, it's rather picky because you have a bunch of boundaries to sum over. But this indeed does come out to be the mass plus the sum of the tensions. So the kind of punchline of this calculation is by doing what's really a first law calculation in terms of the mechanics, but in this kind of different way where you're working on a slice that's at infinity, you get that something is zero, and that something on the one hand is identified as a Noether type charge associated with the scaling field. And on the other hand, if you decompose this, you can see that this actually is the mass plus the sum of the tensions.
So that's
where I start from the point of view of CFT. It's like, of course.
But we also know that CFT symmetry translates into the asymptotic ABS atomic, which is what we're using to get crystals.
So now these are the traces of the this is the trace of the ADM charges. And I think that this might generalize in an interesting way, that if you're once willing to contemplate non-strictly ABS boundary conditions, so suppose you let those coefficients depend upon the positions along this plane. I want to say along the grain, but there's no grain there. Then you actually have another term in here, which looks suspiciously like the mass on this grain world, but there's no grain on this world, plus the sum of the tensions within that world. Let me end by just summarizing the local perturbation calculation. You were asking about that. If you actually write out the linearized equations, and so I was happy to see that. And now I said, well, what about, I expected that I could put down any delta rho and delta pressures that I wanted to. So if you do this calculation with an ADS, so the metric is ADS plus a small perturbation, we're putting down our sources. I'm using all the planar symmetries, simplest possible situation. It's static and uniform in all these plane directions. What you find is that there's a logarithmic mode that has as its source precisely, so you have the metric perturbation goes like some coefficient log r divided by r d minus 1 d minus 3, where this coefficient that I call capital A is the integral of delta rho plus minus. So you make yourself a little model where these are localized sources in some volume of radius epsilon, and you do interior and exterior solutions and match across it. This logarithmic mode has as its source this combination, delta rho minus the sum of the pressures. And if you don't want that logarithm in your asymptotics, then you want this coefficient to be zero, which is precisely the local version of that statement, Chase's condition. So, and the other coefficients to get these ones that you do want are sourced in the usual way by integrals over delta rho and delta pressure, but now there's a relationship between them. So that's all, satisfy my angst about having some contradiction between what you could do in terms of putting any old source down in the space-time and this condition that was coming out. Going back to De Sitter, which I started to talk to with Paul at the beginning of the talk, which is an open question, you can see that in the De Sitter space-time, you have, in the cosmological space-time, which perhaps is evolving to De Sitter, we have a constraint on perturbations. And if you do the analytic continuation of this, that turns that picture on its side, as I'm sure most people are familiar with here at Perimeter. And so it directly translates into some statement that would be in the far future of De Sitter universe. So the question isn't really so much, is there a statement? I mean, there's some kind of statement. The question is, are there meaningful geometrical physical quantities that are interesting questions to ask about the future of the universe, as it were, because that's where it's happening up here at future null infinity, for which for De Sitter, you know, everything ends at future null infinity, not the time-like stuff as well as the space-like stuff. So are there interesting geometrical quantities that when you continue this mass plus the sum of the tensions are something that you care about in cosmology? And instead of having a black hole as the source, or black brain as the source for this, you're talking about, well, what's the source of the deviations from pure De Sitter? And that source was kind of disappear. It's fading away. So you had to have something, an S brain or some phase transition, something that happened that's different from pure De Sitter. And then the effects are still propagating forward in the future, but getting weaker and weaker. So it's approaching De Sitter. Well, getting weaker and weaker in precisely this sense, yeah. Where R goes to Eta. Yeah. Yes, but you're right, you always have something integrated over the whole slice. So I thought that might be the kind of situation that people here might have thought about. And I said, I'm going to be here for the rest of today and all day tomorrow, leaving Thursday morning. I was hoping that maybe folks can Paul will elaborate on what he was saying about just now, but also interested in talking about this future De Sitter. Okay. That's enough. That's more than enough.